Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to The Hour of the Time with your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona. Now I want to thank you for listening this evening, and you can thank yourself because what you're about to learn. Now, ladies and gentlemen, tonight, Tuesday, the 23rd, February 2010, is part 5 in our series on the Israel Lobby and U.S. foreign policy. Now first, if you'd like to write the Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing Hour of the Time, or HOT, H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona 85925. Again, that's Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona 85925. The website, hourofthetime.com, that's hourofthetime.com, and the studio number in Arizona is 928-333-2942, that's 928-333-2942, and in Canada, 613-733-4324. 613-733-4324. Now, my personal email address, if you'd like to share research, you have some questions, and you're concise and to the point, hate mail, suggestions for broadcasting, what have you, it is hourofthetime@hotmail.com. That's hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Now, ladies and gentlemen, don't forget the Hour of the Time is listener-supported. And through your support in the form of donations, either outright or even better yet, donating for research materials, MP3 individual broadcasts, MP3 series that are bundled topically, research in a given subject area, DVDs. We have whole sets of DVDs. There are several specials on the website. There's also printed materials, PDFs, etc. So, ladies and gentlemen, through your donations is how the Hour of the Time stays on the air and brings you broadcasting that most, if not 99%, which is a high most, of broadcasting networks will not dare to touch. We also bring you broadcasting that's documented, which most networks won't do. And we don't fill it up with commercials every 4 minutes, and we don't just pass along every new fax just in or email just in rumor network to get you running around chasing your tail, wasting your time, because that is the MO, the modus operandi, ladies and gentlemen, of most of these agent provocateurs out there. Now, ladies and gentlemen, after the normal introductory musical break, this is the time for you to go get something to write with, take notes during our broadcast, because there's always lots of dates, times, events, acts, bills, legislation during the Hour of the Time. So after this musical break, be prepared tonight, Tuesday, the 23rd of February, 2010, for part 5 in our series on the Israeli lobby and U.S. foreign policy. ladies and gentlemen. Again, your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona, with the Hour of the Time. Now, ladies and gentlemen, again tonight, part 5 in our broadcast series, highlighting the Israel lobby and U.S. foreign policy. Just a brief recap where we left off in the previous episode. We were talking about Israel and the Iraq War. And according to Philip Zelikow, a member of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board from 2001 to 2003, Executive Director of the 9/11 Commission, and then Counselor to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, the quote-unquote real threat from Iraq was not a threat to the United States. The quote-unquote unstated threat was the, quote, threat against Israel. Zelikow told a University of Virginia audience in September 2002, noting further that, quote, the American government doesn't want to lean too hard on it rhetorically because it is not a popular sell. Then, on August 16, 2002, 11 days before Vice President Cheney kicked off the campaign for war with a hard-line speech to the veterans of foreign wars, the Washington Post reported that, quote, Israel is urging U.S. officials not to delay a military strike against Iraq's Saddam Hussein, end quote. By this point, according to Sharon, strategic coordination between Israel and the U.S. had reached, quote, unprecedented dimensions, end quote, and Israeli intelligence officials had given Washington a variety of alarming reports about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs. As one retired Israeli general later put it, quote, Israeli intelligence was a full partner to the picture presented by American and British intelligence regarding Iraq's non-conventional capabilities. End quote. Israeli leaders were deeply distressed when President Bush decided to seek UN Security Council authorization for war in September, and even more worried when Saddam agreed to let UN inspectors back into Iraq, because these developments seemed to reduce the likelihood of war. The Foreign Minister, Shimon Peres, told reporters in September 2002 that, quote, the campaign against Saddam Hussein is a must. Inspections and inspectors are good for decent people, but dishonest people can overcome easily inspections and inspectors, end quote. At the same time, former Prime Minister Barak wrote a New York Times op-ed warning that, quote, the greatest risk now lies in inaction, end quote. His predecessor, Netanyahu, published a similar piece in the Wall Street Journal entitled, quote, The Case for Toppling Saddam. Netanyahu declared, today, nothing less than dismantling his regime will do. I believe I speak for the overwhelming majority of Israelis in supporting a preemptive strike against Saddam's regime, end quote. Or as Haaretz reported in February 2003, quote, the Israeli military and political leadership yearns for war in Iraq, end quote. But, as Netanyahu suggests, the desire for war was not confined to Israel's leaders. Apart from Kuwait, which Saddam conquered in 1990, Israel was the only country in the world where both the politicians and the public enthusiastically favored war. As journalist Gideon Levy observed at the time, quote, Israel is the only country in the West whose leaders support the war unreservedly and where no alternative opinion is voiced. End quote. In fact, Israelis were so gung-ho for war that their allies in America told them to damp down their hawkish rhetoric, lest it look like the war was for Israel. Now, ladies and gentlemen, let's move on to the lobby, as we've referred to it throughout this series, and the Iraq War. For within the United States, the main driving force behind the Iraq War was a small band of neoconservatives, many with close ties to Israel's Likud party. In addition, key leaders of the lobby's major organizations lent their voices to the campaign for war. According to Forward, quote, as President Bush attempted to sell the war in Iraq, America's most important Jewish organizations rallied as one to his defense. In statement after statement, community leaders stressed the need to rid the world of Saddam Hussein and his weapons of mass destruction. End quote. And the editorial goes on to say that, quote, concern for Israel's safety rightfully factored into the deliberations of the main Jewish groups. End quote. Ladies and gentlemen, again, your host here. Sorry, I saw the phone starting to light up, so I had to grab a call. Now the phone line is unhooked, so we should be safe from that. But to continue on, ladies and gentlemen, although neoconservatives and other lobby leaders were eager to invade Iraq, the broader American Jewish community was not. In fact, Samuel Friedman reported just after the war started that, quote, a compilation of nationwide opinion polls by the Pew Research Center shows that Jews are less supportive of the Iraq War than the population at large, 52-62%, end quote. Thus, ladies and gentlemen, and you can see clearly, it would be wrong. Excuse me. Oh, my throat. I'm worn out today, ladies and gentlemen, so hold up. It would be wrong to blame the war in Iraq on Jewish influence. Rather, the war was due in large part to the lobby's influence, especially the neoconservatives within it. You see, the neoconservatives were already determined to topple Saddam before Bush even became president. They caused, in fact, a stir in early 1998 by publishing two open letters to President Clinton calling for Saddam's removal from power. These signatories, many of whom had close ties to pro-Israel groups like Jinza or WNEP, and whose ranks included Elliot Abrams, John Bolton, Douglas Feith, William Kristol, Bernard Lewis, Donald Rumsfeld, Richard Perle, and Paul Wolfowitz, had little trouble convincing the Clinton administration to adopt the general goal of ousting Saddam. But the neoconservatives were unable to sail a war to achieve that objective. Nor were they able to generate much enthusiasm for invading Iraq in the early months of the Bush administration. As important as the neoconservatives were for making the Iraq War happen, they needed help to achieve their aim. That help, ladies and gentlemen, arrived with 9/11. Specifically, the events of that fateful day led Bush and Cheney to reverse course and become strong proponents of a preventative, as it was called, war to topple Saddam. Neoconservatives in the lobby, most notably Scooter Libby, Paul Wolfowitz, and Princeton historian Bernard Lewis, played especially critical roles in persuading the president and vice president to favor war. You see, for the neoconservatives, 9/11 was a golden opportunity to make the case for war with Iraq. At a key meeting with Bush at Camp David on September 15th, Wolfowitz advocated attacking Iraq before Afghanistan, even though there was no evidence that Saddam was involved in the attacks on the United States, and bin Laden was known to be in Afghanistan. Bush rejected this advice and chose to go after Iraq instead, but war with Iraq was now regarded as a serious possibility, and the president tasked U.S. military planners on November 21, 2001, with developing concrete plans for an invasion. Meanwhile, other neoconservatives were at work within the corridors of power. Although the full story is still, to this day, not available. But there are scholars like Louis Anajami of John Hopkins University who reportedly played key roles in convincing Vice President Cheney to favor the war. Cheney's views were also heavily influenced by the neoconservatives on his staff, especially Eric Edelman, John Hanna, and Chief of Staff Libby, one of the most powerful individuals in the administration. The Vice President's influence helped convince President Bush by early 2002. And now, with Bush and Cheney on board, the die for war was cast. Outside the administration, neoconservative pundits lost no time making the case that invading Iraq was essential to winning the war on terrorism. Their efforts were partly aimed at keeping pressure on Bush and partly intended to overcome opposition to the war inside and outside of the government. On September 20th, a group of prominent neoconservatives and their allies published another open letter telling the president that, quote, even if evidence does not link Iraq directly to the 9/11 attack, any strategy aiming at the eradication of terrorism and its sponsors must include a determined effort to remove Saddam Hussein from power in Iraq, end quote. The letter also reminded Bush that, quote, Israel has been and remains America's staunchest ally against international terrorism, end quote. Then, in October 1st issue of the Weekly Standard, Robert Kagan and William Kristol called for regime change in Iraq immediately after the Taliban was defeated. That same day, Charles Krauthammer argued in the Washington Post that after we were done with Afghanistan, Syria should be next, followed by Iran and Iraq. Quote, the war on terrorism, he argued, will conclude in Baghdad when we finish off the most dangerous terrorist regime in the world, end quote. You see, these salvos were the beginning of an unrelenting public relations campaign to win support for invading Iraq. And a key part of this campaign was the manipulation of intelligence information so as to make Saddam look like an imminent threat. For example, Libby visited the CIA several times to pressure analysts to find evidence that would make the case for war. And he helped prepare a detailed briefing on the Iraq threat in early 2003 that was pushed on Colin Powell. Then, preparing his infamous briefing to the UN Security Council on the Iraqi threat. According, in fact, to Bob Woodward, Powell, quote, was appalled at what he considered overreaching and hyperbole. Libby was drawing only the worst conclusion from fragments and silky threads, end quote. Although Powell discarded Libby's most outrageous claims, his UN presentation was still riddled with errors, as Powell later acknowledged. The campaign to manipulate intelligence also involved two organizations that were created after 9/11 and reported directly to Undersecretary of Defense Douglas Feith. The Policy Counterterrorism Evaluation Group was tasked to find links between Al-Qaeda and Iraq that the intelligence community supposedly missed. Its two key members? Wormser, a hardcore neoconservative, and Michael Malhouf, a Lebanese-American who had close ties with Pearl. The Office of Special Plans was tasked with finding evidence that could be used to sell war with Iraq. It was headed by Abraham Shulsky, a neoconservative with long-standing ties to Wolfowitz, and its ranks included recruits from pro-Israel think tanks. Like virtually all the neoconservatives, Feith is deeply committed to Israel. He also has long-standing ties to the Likud party. He wrote articles in the 1990s supporting the settlements and arguing that Israel should retain the occupied territories. More importantly, along with Pearl and Wormser, he wrote the famous Clean Break, as it was called, report in June 1996 for the incoming Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. Among other things, it recommended that Netanyahu focus, quote, on removing Saddam Hussein from power in Iraq, an important Israeli strategic objective in its own right, end quote. It also called for Israel to take steps to reorder the entire Middle East. Netanyahu did not implement their advice, but Feith, Pearl, and Wormser were soon advocating that the Bush administration pursue these same goals. This situation prompted Herod's columnist Akiva Eldar to warn that Feith and Pearl, quote, are walking a fine line between their loyalty to American governments and Israeli interests. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, your host here, Doyle Shamley, in Eager, Arizona, Tuesday, 23rd of February, 2010. The website, hourofthetime.com. The studio in Arizona, 928-333-2942. The studio in Canada, 613-733-4324. And my personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. That's hourofthetime@hotmail.com. And ladies and gentlemen, don't forget that the Hour of the Time is listener supported. And through your support, in the form of donations either outright or better yet, in the form of donations for research materials, go to our website, hourofthetime.com, and then go to the Hot Shop. And there you can see mass collections by topical interest in the form of MP3 or DVD, printed materials, and individual broadcast episodes. That is how, ladies and gentlemen, through your support, that we continue our presence on the air and on the internet and our research and travels and speaking engagements. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to go back to a couple of these very, very critical points. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Fife and Pearl and Wormser or the famous Clean Break Report. But think about it, ladies and gentlemen. I haven't have read it. In 1996, they advised for the incoming Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, most importantly, quote, focus on removing Saddam Hussein from power in Iraq, an important Israeli strategic objective in its own right, end quote. It also called, ladies and gentlemen, don't forget, for Israel to take steps to reorder the entire Middle East. And don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, that other quote, and you can look all these up. From the newspaper Haaretz, columnist Akiva Eldar to warn that Fife and Pearl, quote, are walking a fine line between their loyalty to American governments and Israeli interest, end quote. Now, Wolfowitz, of course, is equally committed to Israel. The Forward, and remember we told you about that in the last broadcast, a Jewish newspaper in and of itself, once described him as the most hawkishly pro-Israel voice in the administration, end quote, and selected him in 2002 as the first among 50 notables who, quote, have consciously pursued Jewish activism, end quote. At about the same time, Jinza gave Wolfowitz its Henry M. Jackson Distinguished Service Award. He received, ladies and gentlemen, that award for promoting a strong partnership between Israel and the United States. And then the Jerusalem Post described him as devoutly pro-Israel, naming him Man of the Year in 2003. But ladies and gentlemen, a brief word is also in order about the neoconservatives' pre-war support of Ahmed Jalabi, the unscrupulous Iraqi exile who headed the Iraqi National Congress, the INC. Hey, I got it right that time. I gave you the name before, the acronym. The Iraqi National Congress. They embraced Jalabi because he had worked to establish close ties with Jewish American groups and had pledged to foster good relations with Israel once he gained power. This was precisely what pro-Israel proponents of regime change wanted to hear. So they backed Jalabi in return. Journalist Matthew Berger laid out the essence of the bargain in the Jewish Journal. Go look it up. Journalist Matthew Berger, the Jewish Journal, quote, The INC saw improved relations as a way to tap Jewish influence in Washington and Jerusalem and to drum up increased support for its cause. For their part, the Jewish groups saw an opportunity to pave the way for better relations between Israel and Iraq, if and when the INC is involved in replacing Saddam Hussein's regime. End quote. Now, given the neoconservatives' devotion to Israel, their obsession with Iraq, and their influence in the Bush administration, it is not surprising that many Americans suspected that the war was designed to further Israeli interest. For example, Barry Jacobs of the American Jewish Committee acknowledged himself, ladies and gentlemen, again, that's Barry Jacobs of the American Jewish Committee, acknowledged in March 2005 that the belief that Israel and the neoconservatives conspired to get the United States into a war in Iraq was, quote-unquote, pervasive in the U.S. intelligence community. Yet, few people would say so publicly. And most that did, including Senator Ernest Hollings, Democrat of South Carolina, and Representative James Moran, Democrat of Virginia, were condemned for raising the issue. Michael Kinsley put the point well in late 2002 when he wrote that, quote, "The lack of public discussion about the role of Israel is the proverbial elephant in the room. Everybody sees it. No one mentions it." End quote. The reason for this reluctance, he observed, was fear of being labeled, guess what, an anti-Semite. Even so, there is little doubt that Israel and the lobby were key factors in shaping the decision for war. Without the lobby's efforts, the United States would have been far less likely to have gone to war in March 2003. Now, ladies and gentlemen, for your notes, let's talk about the goals of regional transformation as another heading, if you will. And you may remember that the Iraq War was not supposed to be a costly quagmire. Rather, it was intended as the first step in a larger plan to reorder the Middle East. This ambitious strategy was a dramatic departure from previous U.S. policy, and the lobby and Israel were critical driving forces behind this shift. This point was made clearly after the Iraq War began in a front-page story in the Wall Street Journal. The headline, ladies and gentlemen, said it all. Quote, "President's dream, changing not just regime but a region. A pro-U.S. democratic area is a goal that has Israeli and neoconservative roots." End quote. You see, pro-Israel forces have long been interested in getting the U.S. military more directly involved in the Middle East so it could help protect Israel. But they had limited success on this front during the Cold War because America acted as an offshore balancer, as it was called, in the region. Most U.S. forces designated for the Middle East, like the Rapid Deployment Force, were kept, as it was termed, over the horizon and out of harm's way. Washington maintained a favorable balance of power by playing local powers off against each other, which is why the Reagan administration supported Saddam against revolutionary Iran during the Iran-Iraq War, which was from 1980 to 1988. Now, this policy changed after the first Gulf War when the Clinton administration adopted a strategy of, quote, dual containment, end quote. it called for stationing substantial U.S. forces in the region to contain both Iran and Iraq instead of using one to check the other. The father of dual containment was none other than Martin Indyke, who first articulated the strategy in May 1993 at the pro-Israel think tank WNAP, and then implemented it as director for the Near East and South Asian Affairs at the National Security Council. Now, I told you in the earlier broadcast, ladies and gentlemen, you're going to hear a lot of these names come up and start seeing the connections over and over again. I hope you took diligent notes. Now, there was, however, considerable dissatisfaction with dual containment by the mid-1990s because it made the United States the mortal enemy of two countries who also hated each other, and it forced Washington to bear the burden of containing both of them. Not surprisingly, the lobby worked actively in Congress to save dual containment. Pressed by AIPAC and other pro-Israel forces, Clinton toughened up the policy in the spring of 1995 by imposing an economic embargo on Iran. But AIPAC et al. Wanted more. The result was the 1996 Iran and Libya Sanctions Act, which imposed sanctions on any foreign companies investing more than $40 million to develop petroleum resources in Iran or Libya. And, as Zaev Schiff, the military correspondent for Haaretz, noted at the time, quote, "Israel is but a tiny element in the big scheme, but one should not conclude that it cannot influence those within the Beltway," end quote. By the late 1990s, however, the neoconservatives were arguing that dual containment was not enough and that regime change in Iraq was now essential. By toppling Saddam and turning Iraq into a vibrant democracy, they argued, the United States would trigger a far-reaching process of change throughout the Middle East. This line of thinking, of course, was evident in the Clean Break study the New York Conservatives wrote for Netanyahu in 1996. By 2002, when invading Iraq had become a front-burner issue, regional transformation had become an article of faith in neoconservative circles. Charles Krauthammer described this grand scheme as the brainchild of Nathan Sharansky, the Israeli politician whose writings have impressed President Bush. But Sharansky was hardly a lone voice in Israel. In fact, Israelis across the political spectrum believed that toppling Saddam would alter the Middle East to Israel's advantage. Aluf Ben reported in Haaretz, February 17th of 2003, quote, "Senior IDF officials and those close to Prime Minister Sharon, such as National Security Advisor Ephraim Halevi, paint a rosy picture of the wonderful future Israel can expect after the war. They envisioned a domino effect, with the fall of Saddam Hussein, followed by that of Israel's other enemies. Along with these leaders will disappear terror and weapons of mass destruction." End quote. In short, ladies and gentlemen, Israeli leaders, neoconservatives, and the Bush administration all saw war with Iraq as the first step in an ambitious campaign to remake the Middle East. And in the first flush of victory, they turned their sights on Israel's other regional opponents. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I would reference some other broadcasts for you and your research. Go to the website, thehourofthetime.com, and go to the Hot Shop And look at the Strategic Hamlet series. Also, look at the Lost History of the HVA. Another broadcast, ladies and gentlemen, if you want a lot of insight into how this came about that we've been discussing in this current series, the Israel lobby and U.S. foreign policy, and with what you're seeing right now in the current big push in the Middle East. For more historical background, you can go to the ADL series. You can also go to the Zionist Violation series or any of the three Mystery Babylons. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona, with the Hour of the Time, Tuesday, the 23rd of February, 2010, Part 5 in our series on the Israel lobby and U.S. foreign policy. And ladies and gentlemen, as I've done already in the previous broadcast, but I'll do it again this evening in case you're just tuning in, this comes from a paper which I stumbled upon, three, 4 years ago, called the Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Now, it was, of course, stifled and snuffed quickly, but it was reviewed by the London Review of Books, and it was also published and written by Professors Mearsheimer of the University of Chicago and Professor Walt of the John F. Kennedy School of Government, Harvard University. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a massive work, but what I found most amazing since owning this was how predictive it was of what we're seeing right now. Predictive in the sense that they didn't need to make predictions, they simply showed a historical timeline and trend. And you could see exactly where we would be at today. See, the Strategic Hamlet and the Lost History of the HVA, I didn't just do those broadcasts for the hell of it in December. And I didn't document all of the Zionist violations for 50 plus years in the Zionist Violation series on a whim. Ladies and gentlemen, what is astounding about this work really is the bibliography in my mind. The bibliography is longer than the textual work itself. The endnotes, the bibliography, the footnotes, all referenced, publications, website links if applicable, dates, times, pages, paragraphs, authors, absolutely stunning. Hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of hours of additional reading just there alone. Now that we've covered a lot of the mechanizations behind the initial push for invasion in Iraq, and based on what they felt was a quick, swift initial victory, seeming so at the time, Now, the next section I would definitely call gunning for Syria. You see, Israeli leaders did not push the Bush administration to exactly put its crosshairs on Syria before March 2003, because they were too busy pushing for war against Iraq. But once Iraq fell, Baghdad, most notably, in mid-April, Sharon and his lieutenants began using Washington to target Damascus. They urged him on April 16th, for example, Sharon and Shaw Mofaz, his defense minister, gave high-profile interviews in different Israeli newspapers. Sharon called for the United States to put very heavy pressure on Syria. Mofaz told Ma'ariv that, quote, "We have a long list of issues that we are thinking of demanding of the Syrians, and it is appropriate that it should be done through the Americans," end quote. Sharon's national security advisor, Halevi, told a WinEP audience that it was now important for the United States to get rough with Syria. And the Washington Post reported that Israel was, quote-unquote, fueling the campaign. Guess who? Against Syria, by feeding the United States intelligence reports about the actions of Syrian President Assad. Prominent members of the lobby made the same arguments after Baghdad fell. Wolfowitz declared that, quote, "There has got to be regime change in Syria," end quote, and Richard Pearl told a journalist that, quote, "We could deliver a short message, a two-worded message, to other hostile regimes in the Middle East. You're next," end quote. In early April, WinEP released a bipartisan report stating that Syria, quote, "should not miss the message that countries that pursue Saddam's reckless, irresponsible, and defiant behavior could end up sharing his fate," end quote. Then, on April 15th, Yossi Klein Halevi wrote a piece in the Los Angeles Times entitled, quote, "Next, turn the screws on Syria." While the next day, Zev Chafee wrote an article for the New York Daily News entitled, quote, "Terror-friendly Syria needs a change too," end quote. And of course, not to be outdone, Lawrence Kaplan wrote in the New Republic on April 21st that Syrian leader Assad was a serious threat to America. Back on Capitol Hill, Congressman Elliot Engel, Democrat, New York, had reintroduced the Syria Accountability and Lebanese Sovereignty Restoration Act on April 12th. It threatened sanctions against Syria if it did not withdraw from Lebanon, give up its, guess what, weapons of mass destruction, and stop supporting terrorism. And it also called for Syria and Lebanon to take concrete steps to make peace with, guess who, Israel. The legislation, of course, was strongly endorsed by the lobby, especially AIPAC, and quote-unquote framed, according to the Jewish Telegraph Agency, quote, by some of Israel's best friends in Congress, end quote. It had been on the back burner for some time, largely because the Bush administration had little enthusiasm for it. But, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you can start to get the hint now if you've taken notes and studied and listened. Guess what? The Anti-Syrian Act passed overwhelmingly, 398-4 in the House, 89-4 in the Senate. And Bush signed it into law on December 12, 2003. Ladies and gentlemen, again, your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona, with the Hour of the Time. Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's crazy that that music queued up at that point. It sounds like the gibberish coming out of Washington. But, ladies and gentlemen, you saw the vote. I just gave you the numbers. And signed into law by Bush on December 12, 2003, as was to be expected. Now remember, though, that the Bush administration was still divided, at this point at least, about the wisdom of targeting Syria. And although the neoconservatives were eager to pick a fight with Damascus, the CIA and the State Department were opposed. And even after Bush signed the new law, he emphasized that he would go slowly in implementing it. To a certain extent, Bush's ambivalence could be seen as understandable. First, the Syrian government had been providing the United States with important intelligence about Al-Qaeda since 9/11, and had also warned Washington about a planned terrorist attack in the Gulf. Syria had also given CIA interrogators access to Mohammed Zamar, the alleged recruiter of some of the 9/11 hijackers. Targeting the Assad regime would jeopardize these valuable connections and thus undermine the larger war. Second, Syria was not on bad terms with Washington before the Iraq War. As an example, it had even voted for UN Resolution 1441. And it was no threat to the United States. Playing hardball with Syria would make the United States look like a bully with an insatiable appetite for beating up Arab states. And finally, putting Syria on the American hit list would give Damascus a powerful incentive to cause trouble in Iraq. Even if one wanted to pressure Syria, it made good sense to finish the job in Iraq first. Yet, Congress insisted on putting the screws to Damascus, largely in response to pressure from Israel officials and pro-Israel groups like AIPAC. If there were no lobby, there would have been no Syria Accountability Act, and U.S. policy towards Damascus would have been more in line with the U.S. national interest. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that's where we'll end this evening, because the next section I want to kind of tackle as a whole, and there's no time tonight to hit it as a whole. But guess what? It is the topic of Iran in this picture and trend by the Israel lobby of manipulating U.S. foreign policy. That's why I want to tackle it as a whole in and of itself. So that's what we'll do in the next segment, the next broadcast, if you will, in this series on the Israel lobby and U.S. foreign policy. Now, again, the website, hourofthetime.com. Your host here, Doyle Shamley, the 23rd Tuesday of February 2010. The studio number in Arizona, 928-333-2942. And in Canada, 613-733-4324, and my personal email address hourofthetime at hotmail.com, and I hope each and every one of you has a safe and a studious evening.